Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Surgical Care Improvement Project conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Denise Faulkner-Cameron.
Thank you, Melina. And good morning again, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this, our 11th conference call as part of the Surgical Care Improvement Project, also known as SCIP. We would also like to extend a special welcome to all of the other hospitals within New York State that perform surgery who are impacted by today's topic of discussion, which is VTE prophylaxis. As you all know, hospitals are required to submit data on the two VTE performance measures included under the SCIP project, beginning with first quarter 2007 discharges, in order to be eligible to receive the full annual payment update from CMS. And because of these changes, we thought it would be beneficial for all hospitals across the state to hear some insights to facilitate their performance and their processes and protocols for this very important aspect of surgical care. And to assist us with this task, we have invited a physician champion in the area of VTE prophylaxis to discuss the recommendations for preventing DVTs and pulmonary embolisms as they are outlined in the ACCP guidelines. And since this is a combined performance improvement and hospital public reporting call, we are also pleased to have with us on the call our lead contact for public reporting, Karen O'Leary. And we will hear from Karen later on when she and I review some common abstraction questions that relate to the VTE indicators. So before I begin, I just want to give those who have not yet had a chance to access the materials for today's call to log on to Jenny, our online community forum at jeny.ibro.org. Remember, there's no www. Simply click on the hospital public reporting link under the hospital forum, and once you're there, click on the link that's referencing today's conference call. The materials that are there include an outline, an agenda outlining the format for the call, a list of abstraction questions, as well as some sample VTE protocols and order forms that we'll discuss later. And lastly, there is an evaluation form that we will remind everyone to complete at the end of the call. Just one additional note, in order to access the slides for the main presentation, click on the link that's within the post labeled Download Presentation. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we're pleased to have with us on the call today a physician champion in the area of VTE prophylaxis, and that is Dr. Stephen Cohn. And just to give you a little background information on Dr. Cohn. He is the clinical professor of medicine and chief division of general internal medicine at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center in Brooklyn. He is also the director of preoperative medical consultation, clinic, and medical consultation service at Kings County Hospital, where he is responsible for education and supervision of senior medical residents in both inpatient and ambulatory care settings. And in addition to that, he chairs the Medicine Performance Improvement Committee at the University Hospital of Brooklyn. After receiving his medical degree from the University of Monterey, Dr. Cohn completed his residency in internal medicine at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. His clinical and research interests include perioperative medicine, particularly cardiac risk evaluation and management, and venous thromboembolic disease. Dr. Cohn has presented research findings and coordinated educational workshops at numerous professional meetings, and he has written several book chapters and articles that have appeared in various peer-reviewed journals, including the Annals of Internal Medicine and Journal of Hospital Medicine. And he is also the editor of a new book entitled Perioperative Medicine, Just the Facts, that was published in 2006. And he is a section editor for medical consultation in a new textbook, Comprehensive Hospital Medicine, that is to be published in August of 2007. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Stephen Cohn.
Thank you, Denise. What I'll be talking about this morning over the next 35 or 40 minutes or so is to highlight the guidelines as it pertains to surgical patients for venous thromboembolic prophylaxis. And the guidelines were last published in 2004. They're currently being updated, and I'm not sure when the new guidelines will be released, but the latest I've heard is going to be hopefully by January 2008 as a supplement to CHEST. Okay, with that, I'll begin. We'll be going through the slides that you have in the handout, and I'll call out the numbers as well in case you somehow get lost. We'll start with a little background of venous thrombosis. A lot of people don't know how prevalent it is. If you look at the numbers, it's said to kill 4 to 5 times more people annually than breast cancer, and it's felt to cause hospital deaths of up to 200,000. And the latest estimate I've heard is 300,000 patients per year in the United States, with an inpatient fatality rate of about 12%. It's felt to be the number one preventable cause of death in hospitalized patients, and as you know, it's getting a lot of attention in the last couple of years. The next slide gives a little more background. Most hospitalized patients that we have today have multiple risk factors for VTE, and they're probably at greater risk than they were in the past. More people have multiple comorbidities, and we have sicker patients than we did 10 years ago. As I mentioned, about 10% of hospital deaths are felt to be due to pulmonary emboli, but 80% of the DVTs are actually silent. What we do know is if you prevent DVTs, you will prevent pulmonary emboli, and prophylaxis has been found to be cost-effective, but is grossly underutilized. Well, some people say that, well, what's the difference if we give the prophylaxis? As long as it's not a fatal pulmonary embolism, we'll treat the patient when they get symptoms of a DVT or a PE. Otherwise, why should I bother with it? And the next slide, number 4, shows that there may be some long-term complications in patients who even develop silent DVTs. Now, this is just illustrating some of the problems that you may see long-term. If you get one DVT, there's an increased incidence of recurrence up to 30% over about a 5 to 10 year period of getting a second DVT or PE. Also, if you get a DVT, looking at chronic leg complications, post-thrombotic syndrome, or what we used to call post-phlebitic syndrome, occurs in 20 to 30% over a 2 to 8 year period. So even though you may feel that this is an asymptomatic disease, later on the patient may be at risk for these long-term complications. So it's important to give prophylaxis. Next slide is looking at the diagnosis. Again, a lot of people are unaware of the problem and the extent of the problem because about 80% of DVTs are clinically silent. And what you're seeing is really the tip of the iceberg, the 20% that actually present with symptoms. Unfortunately, as you know, DVT may go to pulmonary embolism, and over 70% of the PEs are actually detected when it's a little bit too late at autopsy. So again, emphasizing the importance of prophylaxis. The next slide, number 6, is looking at Virchow's triad, and this was published about 150 years ago. He came up with the underlying pathophysiology and risk factors for why patients develop blood clots. And the three elements are stasis, intimal injury, and a hypercoagulable state. And using these three mechanisms, you can assign the risk factors to the various categories and see what the patients actually have. Slide number 7 is showing the risk factors for VTE, and under the first category on the left, you see stasis. And if you think about the patients that you have in the hospital today, the large majority are going to be over age 40. A lot of them, if they were not immobile before they came into the hospital, we make them that way by giving them orders such as bed rest or bed rest with bathroom privileges, or after surgery, they may not be able to get out of bed for the first 24 hours or so. On the medical side, a lot of patients have strokes, heart failure, COPD. Those are also risk factors for stasis and VTE. Giving a patient anesthesia itself is a risk factor for stasis and VTE. And obesity at the bottom is another thing that's highly prevalent, certainly worldwide and in our surgical population as well. If you look at the hypercoagulable state, the risk factors that we typically see, a lot of operations being done for cancer, other patients who are septic, less common for some of the other things that you see here. And on the bottom, endothelial damage, just cutting into the patient can create a problem, as well as any trauma that a patient may have had or putting central lines in patients are also potential risk factors for developing VTE. So looking at these, you can see that the average patient that you'll have in the hospital is probably going to have a minimum of 2, probably 3 or even more of these risk factors. Now what happens if we don't give anybody prophylaxis? On the next slide, number 8, this is showing the absolute risk of DVT in various groups of hospitalized patients. And in the general surgery category, you see the prevalence ranging from about 15 to 40%, similar in GYN surgery. If you go down the list, you can see total hip replacement, total knee replacement, and hip fracture surgery has the highest incidence, actually, 40 to 60, some people say as high as 80%, if not given prophylaxis, similar to major trauma and spinal cord injury. And our critical care patients span from a lower type risk to a very high risk group. So this is what happens if you don't give a patient prophylaxis. But what do we have available? This is slide number 9. You can divide the methods we use for prophylaxis into either mechanical or pharmacologic methods. Under mechanical, we have early ambulation, which everybody who can walk should be up and walking after surgery. Graded elastic stockings, found to be of some value, although not as well studied as the pharmacologic methods. Intermittent pneumatic compression, the same type of thing. Venous foot pumps, which you really don't use, it probably shouldn't be used as much. And IVC filters are only on the list here because I want to mention that there is no primary indication for primary prophylaxis for IVC filters, even though a number of neurosurgeons and a number of oncologists and trauma surgeons like to put them in. As of this point, there's no indication for using an IVC filter as primary prophylaxis. On the other side, under pharmacologic methods, you have unfractionated heparin at varying doses, 5,000 BID or TID, warfarin, which is only used really for the orthopedic patients, low molecular weight heparins, pentasaccharides, oral thrombin inhibitors, which you really don't have on the market yet, but they're in development, and in parentheses, you have aspirin, and I just wanted to highlight that you should not use aspirin alone as prophylaxis in any group. The next slide, number 10, is looking at the risk of developing distal and proximal DVTs, as well as pulmonary embolism, fatal pulmonary PEs, and what the recommended modality is based on the risk categories. And this is for surgical patients. It's a rough grouping. If you have one risk factor, 0 to 1, you're in a low-risk group, and you probably don't really need anything. Two risk factors would put you in a moderate-risk group, where you could probably use either pharmacologic or physical, but they usually still recommend pharmacologic over physical unless there's a contraindication. Once you get to the high-risk group, you can see a significant incidence of calf vein thrombosis, 20 to 40%, and 4 to 8% in the proximals. And here they recommend definitely pharmacologic over physical or even a combined modality. And once you get into the highest risk category, you should try to combine physical and pharmacologic methods. Now, what I'm going to be talking about is the ACCP guidelines. And when I have the recommendations next to them, there's going to be a grading system. It's grade 1 or grade 2 with letters going from A to C or C plus in there as well. And this is how they categorized it. For grade 1 recommendations, they found clear evidence as far as risk-benefit ratios. And if you look at the methodologic strength, if they gave it an A, it means they had randomized controlled trials with no significant limitations. 1B, there were some limitations. A 1C plus, they didn't have the randomized controlled trials, but they could extrapolate from these, from other evidence or felt that they had strong observational studies to support their recommendation, and a 1C by itself was just observational studies. This was not as strong as the other categories. If you go on the next slide, number 12, to grade 2 recommendations, it's the same type of thing you see, but here that the risk-benefit ratio is unclear. So these are not strong recommendations. They're at best intermediate and progressively weaker as you go down from the A to B and C recommendations that you see here. Again, the methodologic strength is still based on the same as in the 1 recommendations, where they had randomized controlled trials for A with no limitations, some limitations in B, et cetera, down the line. So next to each one of these things, you'll see what the ACCP grading system was when I give you the recommendation. Now, slide number 13, just talking about general recommendations, the AHRQ ranked appropriate VTE prophylaxis as the number 1 safety practice on their list, which is why we're interested in it, and it's very important. We have a lot of data that show that there's little or no increase in risk of clinically significant bleeding using prophylactic doses of either low-dose unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, or vitamin K antagonists, or warfarin. And they also recommend that every hospital develop a formal strategy to address prevention of VTE. You should have a written policy, and you should be monitoring what we're doing. The next slide looks at mechanical methods, including the graded elastic stockings and intermittent pneumatic compression devices. All of these can increase venous outflow and reduce stasis in the legs. They all reduce the risk of DVT, although in general they're felt to be less effective than an anticoagulant-based regimen. However, none of them have been shown to reduce the risk of pulmonary embolism or death. The recommendation for mechanical methods is that you should use them primarily in patients who are at high risk of bleeding, and it's a 1C plus recommendation, or as an adjunct to an anticoagulant-based prophylaxis. And again, if you're using mechanical methods, be sure that they fit properly, that they're actually on the patient, and they're being used a large majority of the time. The number that people have said is a minimum of 16 to 18 hours a day, which means if the patient gets up at night, takes them off to go to the bathroom, comes back and doesn't connect them, they may go for an eight-hour period without having the device on. So they may fail because of that type of use. If you look at low molecular weight heparin and low dose unfractionated heparin, they appear to be equally effective in preventing DVT in general surgical patients. However, in the high-risk patients, higher doses of low molecular weight heparin are better than lower doses. This means, for example, for enoxaparin, it's the same dose either way, 40 milligrams once a day or 30 milligrams twice a day in the other group. But for dalteparin, if you use 5,000 units for the high-risk patients as opposed to 2,500 for the low to moderate-risk patients, they feel that there's a benefit of the higher dose. If you look at lower doses of low molecular weight heparin, they were associated with lower bleeding incidences, lower bleeding risk than unfractionated heparin. And the advantage of low molecular weight heparin over low dose unfractionated heparin is that it's typically given once a day and it has a lower incidence or lower risk of heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. Now we're going to go by different groups of surgical patients. We'll start with the general surgical patients. And it's divided into low, moderate, high, and highest risk groups. And here are the low-risk categories. You're considered to be in a low-risk group if you have age under 40 and you're not going for major surgery. The surgery is defined as not being more than 30 minutes or so, and you have no other risk factors, the risk factors typically being previous DVT or pulmonary embolism, malignancy, or hypercoagulable state. So if you don't have any of those, you're under 40, you're going for a short procedure, the recommended regimen is that you don't need anything but aggressive mobilization, no specific pharmacologic or physical method. And these patients are typically the ambulatory surgery patients. They're not patients that we have in the hospital. The next group is the moderate risk patients. These are between ages 40 and 60, going for a major surgery. Or if they are going for a lesser type of surgery or younger, they have other risk factors as well. And here the recommended regimens are low-dose unfractionated heparin, 5,000 Q 12 hours, or low molecular weight heparin, and here you can use the 2,500 units of dalteparin, or you can use the 40 milligrams or 30 milligrams BID dosing of enoxaparin, or graded compression stockings or IPCs, but only if there's a high bleeding risk or as an adjunct to your pharmacologic or anticoagulant-based regimen. So they don't really recommend the mechanical methods as highly as they do the pharmacologic. Similarly, in the high-risk patients, these are now patients over the age of 60 going for major surgery, or younger patients with non-minor surgery if they have other risk factors that I mentioned. And here, if you're using low-dose unfractionated heparin, and I do want to highlight this point, the recommendation for the high-risk group is that you should use it every 8 hours, not every 12 hours. Otherwise, you should be using low molecular weight heparin at the higher dose that I mentioned before, or intermittent pneumatic compression, again, only if it's a high bleeding risk or as an adjunct to your anticoagulant-based regimen. And finally, slide number 19 shows the highest risk patients, and now we start to get away from the general surgery patients a little bit. These are orthopedic patients going for major joint replacements, hips or knees, or hip fracture surgery, or major trauma, and here they recommend a higher dose of low molecular weight heparin, or fondaparinux, which is a synthetic 10A inhibitor, or vitamin K antagonist, warfarin with a target INR between 2 and 3. And they also recommend that you can combine intermittent pneumatic compression or graded stockings with low molecular weight heparin and possibly with low-dose unfractionated heparin. But if you'll notice, there's no place or no role for low-dose unfractionated heparin alone in this highest risk category. So typically they're recommending the low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, or warfarin for these patients. And we'll come back to this when I talk about orthopedic surgery. And this just summarizes the recommendations for general surgery. Again, it may be difficult to see on your handout there, but for the low-risk people, again, early ambulation, no specific prophylaxis. It's a 1C plus recommendation. The moderate-risk patient, unfractionated heparin 5,000 BID or low molecular weight heparin at the lower doses, a 1A recommendation. The high-risk group, low-dose unfractionated heparin 3 times a day or low molecular weight heparin at the higher dose, 1A recommendations. In your high-risk patients with multiple risk factors, combined modalities, patients at high risk of bleeding, the mechanical methods at least until the bleeding risk decreases, and for select high-risk patients, again, it's low molecular weight heparin. And they talk about the doses at the bottom of this slide. Now we'll move on to gynecologic surgery. And if you look at these patients, the incidence of DVT is about the same as it is with general surgical patients. And if you look at some of the factors that may increase the risk of developing a VTE in GYN surgery patients, a lot of times they may be older patients. They may have had a previous VTE. They're typically a lot of times going for surgery for cancer, and it's an abdominal or pelvic procedure. So all of these things are potential risk factors for developing blood clots. And as they say that patients who are having surgery for GYN cancers get less protection from BID dosing of unfractionated heparin than those with benign disease, and this will lead into the recommendations on the next slide. For GYN surgery, if it's a brief procedure for benign disease, again, nothing. Early ambulation, and it's a 1C plus recommendation. For laparoscopic GYN procedures, if you have other risk factors, either age or something else, you can use unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, or pneumatic compression devices, and these are 1C recommendations. If it's a major GYN procedure for benign disease, you can still use the BID dosing of unfractionated heparin. That's a 1A recommendation. But other alternatives are low molecular weight heparin and IPC as well. If a patient's undergoing major surgery for malignancy, this is where you need to use unfractionated heparin 3 times a day if you choose to use that, or the higher doses of low molecular weight heparin. And again, these are the 1A recommendations. Something that you may not be doing or may not be aware of, if you're at high risk and going for cancer surgery or you've had a previous DVT, they recommend extended prophylaxis in these cancer surgery patients for 2 to 4 weeks after hospital discharge. It's a weak recommendation, but there are more and more studies coming out showing that these cancer patients are at risk after they leave the hospital and would probably benefit by extended prophylaxis. Next slide, number 23, is looking at urologic surgery. And here the risk is relatively low compared to the other things we've talked about. It's only about 1 to 5%. However, venous thromboembolism is considered to be the most important non-surgical complication in these patients. And some of the risk factors that they have, or some of the risk factors that will put them at the higher end or above the 5% risk, would be open procedures compared to transurethral procedures, urologic surgery for malignancy as opposed to a benign process, older age, longer duration of procedure, and the position that the patient is in when they operate, in the lithotomy position. And the next slide goes over the recommendations for urologic surgery, for prophylaxis. And if it's a low-risk procedure, like a TURP, transurethral procedures, again, only post-op ambulation, no specific prophylaxis is recommended. On the other hand, you go to the major open procedures, they recommend either unfractionated heparin, BID or TID, or IPC, or graded elastic stockings, or low molecular weight heparin. But they want you to give something for the major open procedures, even though the risk is lower than it is for general surgery. Again, there are select procedures within this that will put you in a higher risk. The next category is patients who have multiple risk factors. Here they recommend the mechanical device in conjunction with either low-dose unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin, and it's a 1C plus recommendation, not as strong as some of the general surgery recommendations. And in patients who are at very high risk of bleeding, use mechanical prophylaxis until that risk decreases. Now, what about laparoscopic surgery? This is slide number 25. Even though we feel that laparoscopic surgery overall may be a lower risk procedure than an open operation, it's typically associated with longer surgical times but shorter hospital stays. And when we do certain things during laparoscopic surgery, we may actually create more of a risk. So both pneumoperitoneum and reverse Trendelenburg position reduce venous return from the legs, and you may create more stasis than a patient would have had if they were just flat on the table. The issue is that we don't have as much information or enough information on laparoscopic surgery about the risk because it hasn't been studied as well as open procedures, but it seems that it's probably relatively low compared to open surgical procedures. However, patients who are at higher risk can be considered for brief prophylaxis with the usual modalities that we've talked about, and we do need more information on laparoscopic surgery and the risk of VTE. So what have the ACCP guidelines said? They say if there's general recommendation for laparoscopic surgery, you don't need routine prophylaxis, only early mobilization, but if the patient has other risk factors, and the large majority of our patients will, then you can use unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, IPC, or graded stockings. Now we'll switch to the highest category of surgery, which is orthopedic surgery. This is now slide number 27. And if you don't give prophylaxis, as I mentioned earlier, the risk of developing a VTE is about 40 to 60% in patients who are going for hip replacement, knee replacement, or hip fracture surgery. The important thing to note is that most symptomatic VTE occurs after the patient is out of the hospital. So when you say you don't see it, a lot of times it's because the patient didn't have it in the hospital that they do develop symptomatic VTE later on. And for example, the peak incidence after total knee replacement is about 7 to 10 days, and after hip replacement it's about 14 to 20 days. So if the patient's only in the hospital for 5 days or then gets transferred to a rehab facility, you may not be aware that the patient developed a VTE. When they made the recommendations for orthopedic surgery, they put a relatively low value on preventing VTE and a higher value on minimizing bleeding complications. And with knee surgery, it may be more of a problem than with hip surgery. So people have done different things and veered away, a little bit away from the guidelines at some time. But it's important to recognize what we need to do because these patients are at the highest risk. So what do they recommend? And the recommendations are similar for hip replacement, knee replacement, and hip fracture surgery. The evidence is slightly different. That's why it's listed separately on this slide. But for total hip replacement, the recommendations for prophylaxis include low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, or vitamin K antagonists, all of which are 1A recommendations. And they recommend against the use of aspirin, dextran, low-dose unfractionated heparin, or mechanical methods alone, as the only method of prophylaxis, and it's a 1A recommendation against those things. Similarly, for total knee replacement, the recommendation is for the higher dose of low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux, and vitamin K antagonist, again 1A, and an alternative is to have optimal use of IPC devices. It's a 1B recommendation, and again, there's that strong recommendation against sole therapy with aspirin or low-dose unfractionated heparin. For arthroscopy, you don't necessarily need any routine prophylaxis unless the patient has other risk factors. And for hip fracture surgery, the one with the drug with the strongest recommendation is fondaparinux because they actually did the studies on hip fracture surgery for FDA approval. It's a 1A recommendation. Otherwise, you can use low molecular weight heparin with a 1C plus recommendation or vitamin K antagonist with a target INR between 2 and 3, a little weaker recommendation. And they say even you can use low-dose unfractionated heparin. I would caution about the low-dose unfractionated heparin unless the patient is sitting around on the floor for several days waiting to go to surgery, in which case they could be considered more like a general surgical patient than an orthopedic surgery patient. If surgery is delayed, they say you can use that unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin between admission and when the patient goes to surgery. On the other hand, if you feel the patient is high risk for bleeding, then you can consider mechanical prophylaxis alone. But these patients really need combined modalities. These are the highest risk patients we have. You also need to consider the type of anesthesia that they will have if it's an epidural or spinal anesthesia, and we'll get to that in a minute. Now, when should you give the prophylaxis? Again, you have to balance the risk of bleeding and risk of preventing the DVT, and it's based on the agent that you're using. There are some small differences for low molecular weight heparin between starting preoperatively and starting postoperatively. Both options are acceptable. And again, the duration of therapy, and this I'd like to point out because this is something that's very important, extended prophylaxis for total hip replacement and hip fracture surgery is a 1A recommendation to continue outpatient or extended prophylaxis for up to 4 to 5 weeks after surgery. Again, the reason being that the peak incidence of DVT in hip surgery is about 2 to 3 weeks after the procedure. So giving 7 to 10 days of prophylaxis, you're missing the peak that the patient is at risk. So for total hip replacement, they recommend low molecular weight heparin, vitamin K antagonists as 1A recommendations for extended prophylaxis, a little bit weaker for fondaparinux. For hip fracture surgery, it's stronger recommendation for extended prophylaxis with fondaparinux and a little bit weaker but still okay for low molecular weight heparin and vitamin K antagonists. The other thing I'd like to point out is as far as screening patients before they go home with ultrasound, it's a 1A recommendation not to do this in asymptomatic patients. First, screening asymptomatic patients, the results are not as good. Second, if you're screening the patient before they go home and it's 5 days or 7 days after surgery, the fact that they don't have a clot there doesn't mean anything because, as I just said, the peak incidence for hips is going to be 2 to 3 weeks after surgery. So you may be lulled into a false sense of security if you feel that there's a negative ultrasound, the patient doesn't need any more prophylaxis, and you then send them home. And a week or two later, they develop a clot. Next slide, it goes to neurosurgery. This is slide number 30. Prevalence of DVT is about 22%, with 5% being proximal in the neurosurgical patients. Those who are at higher risk include patients undergoing intracranial surgery, those that have malignant tumors as opposed to benign tumors, longer duration of the procedure, leg weakness, so they're more likely to develop stasis, and older patients, increased age. What does the ACCP recommend for neurosurgical patients? If it's an intracranial operation, they're usually trying to go with the mechanical methods because there's a slight increased incidence of intracranial bleeding with pharmacologic therapy, even though they may be somewhat more effective in preventing DVTs. So the recommendation for intracranial neurosurgery is an IPC device with or without graded compression stockings. That's a 1A recommendation. They say that you can use unfractionated heparin or postoperative low molecular weight heparin, somewhat weaker recommendations. If the patients are at high risk, they say you can combine your mechanical device with the pharmacologic methods as well. Typically what we do is the patients are getting both while they're waiting for the neurosurgery. They hold the dose of pharmacologic prophylaxis before the patient goes to the OR, and they wait anywhere from 24 hours to 72 hours afterwards to restart the pharmacologic prophylaxis while continuing the IPCs. What about elective spinal cord surgery? Spinal cord injury patients have an extremely high incidence of developing DVTs, but we're talking about patients who come in for elective surgery, not patients with spinal cord injury. And the incidence seems to be lower than it is for a lower extremity surgery, but some patients may have more risk, especially if they have any of the risk factors that you note here. Again, increased age, if they're operated on for the lumbar spine as opposed to the neck, if it's a combined anterior or anterior-posterior approach, it may be a higher risk. If they're manipulating the iliac veins and vena cava, that increases your risk. If it's spinal cord surgery because the patient has a malignancy there, again, another risk factor. Prolonged surgery and reduced mobility also increase the risk that patient develops post-op VTE. So what do they recommend? In general, if there's no other risk factors, and this is only going to be a young patient, maybe for a herniated disc, for example, they say you don't need routine prophylaxis, only early mobilization. On the other hand, if it's an older patient, and they have other risk factors that you see here, then they recommend postoperative unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin or perioperative use of an IPC device. And you can also use graded elastic stockings or a combination therapy. If you have multiple risk factors, they do feel that you should get pharmacologic-based therapy with either low-dose unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin combined with graded stockings and or an IPC device. It's a 1C-plus recommendation. What about lower extremity injuries? This is not necessarily elective surgery, although sometimes they are scheduled electively. If you have a below knee injury, there's about a 10 to 40% chance of getting an asymptomatic DVT, and as it gets closer to the knee, you have a higher incidence of getting the complication. The risk factors include advanced age again, presence of fractures as opposed to just soft tissue injuries, and obesity. If you give prophylaxis with low molecular weight heparin, you do reduce the frequency of DVT, but it's the asymptomatic DVTs. And although most of the countries in Europe, a lot of the countries in Europe, do give routine prophylaxis for these procedures, the ACCP made a recommendation that we not use prophylaxis routinely in these patients with isolated lower extremity injuries because they don't have data to show that the risk of important VTEs is reduced by our pharmacologic prophylaxis. Personally, I think most of the orthopedic physicians tend to use prophylaxis anyway in this country, even though the recommendation by the ACCP is that we don't have evidence to support it. Now, a few special situations I wanted to go over. One is the patient with renal impairment. Most of these drugs, the pharmacologic drugs, are cleared by the kidney, so low molecular weight heparin, fondaparinux. It's important to note what the patient's renal function is. and you need to consider what the dosing changes or recommendations or contraindications are. And basically, for creatinine clearances greater than 30, there's usually no dose reduction or adjustment that needs to be made. But when a patient has a creatinine clearance less than 30, you need to reduce the dose of low molecular weight heparin. For example, enoxaparin, instead of giving 40 milligrams once a day, it becomes 30 milligrams once a day. For dalteparin, there is no recommendation. They say use with caution, which means if you can't monitor anti-10A levels, you probably shouldn't use it. And for fondaparinux, it's really contraindicated because this drug has a very long half-life, 17 hours or so, and it's metabolized by the kidney. So you should avoid that with renal insufficiency. For dialysis, we don't know what to do, so I would avoid the low molecular weight heparins and fondaparinux in dialysis patients and just go with unfractionated heparin. As far as neuraxial anesthesia or analgesia, this is spinal or epidural anesthesia or an epidural catheter that's left in afterwards. What you need to do is if a patient is on heparin or low molecular weight heparin, you need to hold the dose for at least 8 to 12 hours before they stick that catheter in. And if a patient's on a higher dose of low molecular weight heparin or a treatment dose, you need to stop it 18 to 24 hours before surgery, before they stick that catheter in or the needle in. The other thing is if patients are going to have an epidural catheter, typically what we do in the United States with low molecular weight heparins is we do not give a dose that day. We wait till the following morning and then start the low molecular weight heparin. In the interim, you use pneumatic compression devices. If a patient is going to have an epidural catheter, you wait 2 hours after you pull the catheter before you start or restart your pharmacologic prophylaxis. Again, fondaparinux should not be used in anybody that you're planning to do spinal or epidural anesthesia because it has a very long half-life, and if there's any bleeding complication, the patient may run into more trouble than with the other agents. Now, I just wanted to highlight a few things in the last few minutes here that the Joint Commission is looking at this point. There's 55 hospitals where they're beta testing some items that they're planning to include in 2008 in their survey, and they may be publicly reportable items similar to the core measures that we have. And what's highlighted here is the 8 things that are in white as opposed to the 2 that are in gray. They're looking at risk assessment and prophylaxis within 24 hours of hospital admission or transfer to the ICU. I'm sure that those things will probably be implemented because that's really the essence of what they're looking for. Similarly, number 10 down at the bottom, we currently do in New York. This is what's called NIPORT cases. These are potentially preventable hospital-acquired VTEs. Even if the patient got prophylaxis, it's still a reportable case. So this is not somebody who comes in with a DVT or PE, somebody who develops it in the hospital. So they want to know, did we use prophylaxis? Was the prophylaxis effective? And they're just tracking all these VTEs that occur in the hospital. They're looking at the indications back up at number 3 for IVC filters, since a number of surgeons are using them. They want to know who's using them, what indications, and they may or may not choose to use this. Again, how you use parenteral therapy, your unfractionated or low molecular weight heparin overlapping with warfarin therapy. Platelet count monitoring, looking for heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, may be something that they're looking at as well. For treatment, in number 7, they're saying if you use IV unfractionated heparin as opposed to low molecular weight heparin for treatment, how are you doing it? Are you winging it, or are you using an official weight-based nomogram to try to calculate the proper dose? And I think number 8 is something else that they'll probably look at, which is VTE discharge instructions, telling the patient that they're going out on warfarin, about diet, about bleeding complications, and about monitoring. So we'll see by the end of this year what the Joint Commission comes up with, but they're planning to implement at least several of these things starting in January of 2008. I just wanted to mention a few things that we did at University Hospital of Brooklyn here in Downstate over the past few years. I couldn't believe when I heard that prophylaxis rates in general were below 50% and sometimes as low as 20 or 30%. I said, well, we must be better than that. We're a university hospital. And then they came out with an article saying university hospitals were probably worse than community hospitals. But in any case, we looked around at baseline rates in October of 2002. This is on our medical patients, but the same thing can apply to the surgical services as well. And only 47% of our patients on the medical service were getting some form of prophylaxis, not necessarily the recommended prophylaxis, but anything. So we then undertook an intervention using the chief resident to give an orientation every month for a few minutes to the incoming house staff. They all got risk factor cards similar to what I showed you before with the Virchow's triad risk factors. We had the nurse educator come in to tell the nurses what the risk factors were, and maybe they could oversee the physicians, and if they felt that a patient was at risk for DVT, and no prophylaxis was given. They would remind us since we didn't have a computerized system. We had posters with risk factors placed all over the nursing stations and physicians' offices. And at the end of the month, unannounced, I would come by and audit the charts and go over them with the house staff and with the hospitalists and other attendings. And what we found a year later is that our prophylaxis rates had gone up to 87%, and we continued to monitor for the next 6 months. Otherwise, people would have said it probably drops off. We stayed at exactly the same number, 87%, and at which point I stopped looking at it. We just had our QA nurses doing ongoing reviews, but smaller numbers of patients. And in last year, and basically 2006, we've been running between 95 and 100% prophylaxis on a medical service. And this is without my audits anymore. Even better than that, the appropriateness of prophylaxis increased from 43% being recommended at the beginning to 68% of the year, and then 85% were given the appropriate prophylaxis at 18 months. This wound up ballooning into a much bigger project than we had anticipated, and it wound up getting published in the Journal of Hospital Medicine last year in December. So what we did on medicine cost very little money. It just involved some of my time, but somebody else can be the champion at their hospital as well, and the chief resident's orientation and some nursing involvement, but the hospital liked it because it didn't really cost them anything. And you can do the same type of thing on the surgical services. First, you need to get a baseline of what you're doing. Then you need to get the orientation going and the education process going with some audit, and then hopefully it will just go by itself and improve rates of prophylaxis. Now, the last two slides, 38 and 39, basically are giving a review, a summary table of what I've mentioned for the different types of surgery. And you can see the columns list low molecular weight heparin, low-dose unfractionated heparin, vitamin K antagonists or warfarin, and fondaparinux, and what the recommendation is, along with the recommended level of recommendation 1A, et cetera. So I'm not going to go over these two. This is just for your own benefit here. And we'll summarize at the last slide, just mentioning again that venous thromboembolic disease is highly prevalent, but it is a preventable disorder, and it's associated with a lot of morbidity and mortality. Most of the patients we have in the hospital today are at increased risk. I would put them in at least a moderate risk category, if not a high risk category, for VTE. If you give prophylaxis for VTE, it would be very beneficial because it's currently underprescribed and underutilized. And there's a study coming out now in Canada showing only about 25 to 35% of patients in Canada got prophylaxis. If you do give appropriate prophylaxis, it reduces the risk of DVT and PE without significantly increasing the risk of bleeding. And prophylaxis tends to be efficacious in about a two-thirds reduction in a lot of populations. And what you need to do is to risk stratify all your patients on admission and be sure to prescribe the appropriate prophylaxis based on the guidelines. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you for your attention. I'll take questions later, and I'll turn the program back over to Denise. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cole, for that comprehensive overview of both the ACCP guidelines and for the helpful insights for preventing DVTs and pulmonary embolisms. And we also thank you for sharing your experiences at your facility. Dr. Cohn is going to remain with us for the remainder of the call, so all of our participants will get a chance later on to ask him questions. So at this time, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to briefly go over some common questions regarding abstractions for the VTE indicators that we have been getting from our hospital. And I just want to make one note about the questions. We are fully aware that hospitals may be at different phases of abstracting. Some hospitals may have already abstracted and submitted their cases for first quarter 2007. However, the questions that we are reviewing, again, are questions that we commonly receive here at IPRA from our hospitals, as well as questions that have been frequently submitted to QNET Quest. So that's why we just decided to focus on these questions. And should there be additional questions in the future, we will make every effort to accommodate that as well. And any question that's asked at this during this call, if we're not able to present you with an accurate answer, we will do the necessary research to get you an answer at a later date and time. So at this time, I'm going to invite Karen to begin us with the discussion on the questions.
Thanks, Denise, and good morning, everybody. Like Denise had said, this is just a sampling, no pun intended there for skip sampling, of questions that we've received and have looked at on QNET Quest for further clarifications. Okay, number one, The tables outlining the recommended prophylaxis for general surgery on page 4 of the measure information section for the VTE indicators refers us to table 519 in Appendix A. There are no codes for cardiac or vascular procedures on table 519. What is the recommended prophylaxis for these procedures?
Well, since patients who undergo cardiac or vascular procedures are usually on anticoagulants for these procedures, they're not included in the population for VTE, and that's why they do not appear on table 5.9.
Number two, our hospital has several cases where patients underwent a principal procedure of 54.91 percutaneous abdominal drainage or 51.43 insert tube for drainage. These are not actual surgical procedures and can be done at the bedside in the ED, GI lab, or invasive radiology lab, and require no incision time since there is no incision. However, these codes are on tables 5.10 and 5.19 and are included in the population for the VTE measures, which require a value to be entered for the surgical incision time data elements. What time should we use in the absence of an incision time?
CMS is fully aware that Appendix A, Table 5.10, which is version 2.1D for discharges fourth quarter 2006 to first quarter 2007, they contain some non-surgical codes. First and foremost, I just want to point out that this will no longer be an issue beginning with discharges for April 1st, 2007 and forward, as these codes will no longer appear on Table 5.10. And if you look on the tables for the April 1st, 2000 manual, you will see that those codes no longer appear. However, for the time being, since they currently do exist for first quarter 2007, if an incision time is not documented, there are other time values that you can choose from. For instance, case start time, procedure start time, just to name a few. If you take a look at the guidelines for abstraction, there is an inclusion list for each of the data elements that are allowed. In the event that no choices are available, then you should use whatever vendor, whatever value your vendor recommends for missing data. Furthermore, if there is no incision time or start time, the case will get excluded from the indicators.
Okay, number three. Why is the data element discharge time required for the VTE indicators?
Well, patients have to stay in the hospital for more than 24 hours postoperatively to be included in the SCIP VTE population. So the data element discharge time helps determine how long the patient stays. To determine if they are going to be included in the population for the measures or excluded.
Number four, taking into account that the VTE2 measure allows the patient to receive the appropriate prophylaxis 24 hours prior to surgery in order to pass the measure, if the patient takes Lovenox at home 24 hours prior to the incision time, can this be counted as timely DVT prophylaxis?
No. Any medications prescribed or administered prior to admission would not count. Remember, definition of VTE prophylaxis is documentation of VTE prophylaxis ordered anytime during the current hospital admission.
Okay, and we're on number five now. And for this question, there are two similar questions related to the same measure. Number one, if there is documentation that mechanical VTE prophylaxis was implemented on the OR circulation record or on the surgeon's operative notes, and the physician signs the record, would that alone be acceptable for VTE prophylaxis ordered? And if there is a hospital-wide protocol that require SCDs to be applied after surgery in the PACU, unless contraindicated, does there still need to be a physician order for the mechanical VTE prophylaxis?
For both of these questions, the only allowable source for VTE prophylaxis is a physician order. This data element cannot be abstracted from protocols, circulation records, or operative reports. And what's more important to keep in mind, in the event that one of these charts is selected for validation, the only place that the CVAC abstractor is going to look for VTE prophylaxis is the physician order sheet.
Number six, a physician documents that the patient is actively bleeding from an incision on the day of surgery, and the bleeding has stopped by post-op day one. However, he does not document this bleeding as a reason for not ordering pharmacological prophylaxis. How would you answer the data element documented bleeding risk?
Scenario, the answer would be no. Remember, there has to be clear documentation of current bleeding or bleeding risk in order to answer yes to documented bleeding list. Documentation according to the patient's current condition alone will not suffice. The physician must document the reason pharmacological prophylaxis is contraindicated. Keep in mind further that depending on the type of surgery being performed, mechanical prophylaxis alone may be appropriate. Thank you, Karen. That concludes the review of the questions that have been submitted to us. I do just want to note that we will post the responses that we just reviewed to Jenny so you would have them for future references. And just in response to questions 5 and 6, the last questions that we reviewed, since they're the ones that we commonly hear the most, I just wanted to point your attention to two resources that we posted in the materials, we included in the materials for today's call. The first one is some guidelines for preventing DVT that one of our hospitals participating in the SCIP Identified Participant Group agreed to share with all of the participants today, and that is the team from the JT Mather Hospital out in Port Jefferson. And it completely outlines all of the a number of the procedures that are included in the VTE indicators for the SCIP project, and it also has the recommended prophylaxis as well as risk assessment, and it is based on the ACCP guidelines, and it also includes the grading system for of recommendations that Dr. Cohn reviewed during his presentation. So it is definitely a useful guide and a resource for hospitals that are looking to develop or revise their protocols to comply with the current ACCP guidelines. I would also like to point your attention to another form that we included, which is actually an assessment and order form. And you may be familiar with this because we have submitted it as part of our tips for the monthly at-a-glance newsletter that Karen sends out. And it is, again, both an assessment form that can be completed upon the patient's admission to the hospital, and it has a section on the bottom for the physician to sign off. And I also would like to point your attention to the box in the upper right-hand corner that's entitled, that's labeled contraindication to pharmacological prophylaxis. And you'll see that there are some check boxes for these contraindications, including active bleeding. And in the event that this form is completed to have a check here with the physician's sign-off, this would be adequate documentation for the contraindication to the pharmacological prophylaxis due to bleeding, which is in response to question 6. And also, because the physician signs off on this would be adequate documentation of a physician order, which, again, is in response to question 5. Specifically, when it comes to the mechanical device, as we've heard from a lot of hospitals, there may not necessarily be an order for mechanical device. Of course, for the pharmacological prophylaxis, you will always have a physician order, but some hospitals may be getting dinged on the first indicator when it comes to documentation of a physician order for the mechanical prophylaxis. So again, we hope you'll find this as a useful resource in revising your protocols to comply with that. So at this time, we're going to open up the lines for questions and answers. We're going to welcome questions for Dr. Cohn. as well as any questions you may have regarding the VTE indicators. And I would like to further invite any hospital on the line who is willing to share any insights on their best practices and any experiences that they've been having with regards to the VTE indicators. So at this time, Alina, can we please open the lines for any questions from our audience?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Kathleen McCullough from Nyack Hospital.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much, Doctor. First of all, I'm the PI clinical reviewer that focuses on SCIPs, and this week the general surgeons have had a couple of concerns regarding postoperative bleeding after giving Lovenox on a couple of colon cases. Their sample size that we report is relatively small, but their incidence so far in the last 3 weeks has been pretty high considering the N. If they document just risk of bleeding, are we covered for obstruction? Hello?
Yeah, this is Dr. Cohen.
Hi.
I think the question should actually be answered by Denise for that.
All right. Well, but in your thing, do you have anywhere where I can go to show them data? Because this one particular person that bled dropped 7 points in her crit and had no risk factors whatsoever. So now they're really a little leery.
Right. There are a number of studies using Lovenox in abdominal surgery patients.
Okay.
And no significant difference in terms of risk compared to whatever the comparator was. Again, you just have to ensure that you have adequate hemostasis before you
right.
Get the belly. Otherwise, they'll bleed.
Absolutely.
Them. So I don't think that there's a specific contraindication. They might, based on what they're doing now, just use pneumatic compression initially and then postoperatively give the Lovenox instead of preoperatively giving the Lovenox, if that's what they did.
No, these were all postoperative.
Well, just given post-op.
Yeah.
Because if you look at a lot of the studies, they were given, the recommendation is actually to give it 2 hours pre-op.
Okay.
And then post-op, but a lot of surgeons tend not to use it pre-op.
Right.
So we haven't seen that, but...
Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I have a big critical care background, so I even knew myself they were hemodynamically stable, so I was a little leery. Now I feel like I'm up against a wall now trying to get them to even continue this.
Right. I can try to get you information on abdominal surgery and enoxaparin, if that's what
you All right. That would be great. Can I speak to the other nurses then regarding obstruction?
Sure.
Thank you. Hello?
Denise, are you on the line?
Hi, Denise, Kathleen. So if these doctors now that are quite hesitant this week, I was making great progress, and all of a sudden I get them to do what they want, what we need them to do, and they've had a couple of instances in the last 2 weeks of postoperative bleeding. If they just write risk of bleeding, we're covered, even if there isn't a... They can just write potential risk of bleeding, Lovenox held, Benadine applied.
If all of that, I would agree with you.
Okay, because
all,
I think...
All of that information you just read.
If two of them will not order Lovenox anymore. So I said, that's fine. If you document a potential risk of bleeding, Lovenox held, and order Benadine, we should be okay. But then our numbers are going to drop dramatically. They're going to just not order pharmacological measures now.
And Denise, are you on the line?
Is this Karen?
Yeah, it is.
Hi, it's Kathleen.
I'm struggling with you here. I would also advise for the physician to add a reason, if it's at all possible. If you can't get that out of them, you know,
but
I want
like,
to help your numbers. So
right, but as long as they write a risk of bleeding, it should fall out of the denominator, correct?
Correct.
All right, because, like, these particular patients, Karen, had no risk. It wasn't like they had an epidural. It wasn't that they had blood disorders or any kind of coagulation problem. They just bled out. Now I'm dealing with, you know.
Yeah, I understand that. Can I?
I'll talk to you on the side. I'll shoot you an email regarding it.
Thank you.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from James Goldser from Townshore Medical Center.
Oh, hi. Thank you. We were distributed a guideline for the various types of surgery and what was required for the SCIP. And there's a lot of discrepancies between the ACCP guidelines and what I'm seeing on here. For example, patients who have had vascular, urological, neurological, and GYN surgery, according to this page that was distributed, do not require pharmacological prophylaxis. How do we resolve that discrepancy?
I'll only answer the ACCP part of it, not the other thing that was distributed. Again, based on what I said, those procedures certainly seem to be procedures that would require it unless the patient happens to be 25 years old, which I doubt. So I don't know why they say they don't need any prophylaxis unless it's a very short procedure. Then it wouldn't fall into those categories.
What about C-sections?
Yeah, C-section is a short procedure. It's less than 30 minutes. And the OB society is not clear in terms of what their own recommendations are. So for C-section, they may argue that you don't need anything or you don't need anything preoperatively. It's a young patient, usually under the age of 40. Procedure's usually less than 30 minutes. So that would fall into a low-risk category where technically you don't need to give anything, but you need to balance if there's any other risk factors.
Okay, then may I ask the other abstracting experts, is it true, first of all, that according to Skip, neurosurgery, urological surgery, gynecological surgery, and vascular surgery do not require pharmacological prophylaxis?
Hi, Dr. Golter. This is Dr. Stimler. Can folks hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. There are options under all the surgery types that you listed for both pharmacologic options as well as, I believe it's IPC. I believe IPC is considered by the ACCP guidelines as well as by CMS to be a reasonable alternative, certainly in many types of GYN surgery. Is that the point you're making, that there are options, alternatives, mechanical prophylaxis alternatives to pharmacologic prophylaxis for those surgeries?
Yes, it's indicating that intermittent pneumatic compression devices alone are satisfactory for the gynecological, urological, neurosurgical, and vascular cases. So will VTE 1 and 2 pass if pharmacological agents are held on those types of cases?
In general, yes. I mean, I don't have the actual chart in front of me, but I believe that for urological, gynecological, and I believe neurological, I'm pretty sure about that they will pass, yes.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Elizabeth Clora from Winthrop University Hospital.
Yes, hi. This question is for Dr. Cohn. We have a number of patients that go for bilateral total knee replacements, and they're receiving epidural anesthesia and pain management. So in terms of the VTE prophylaxis, mechanical there, we're using foot cuffs. We're not applying calf cuffs to these knee patients. And in terms of giving them any kind of low molecular weight heparin, it's given after the epidural is removed. In this case, it's well after the time frame in order to pass this measure. My question is twofold. What will we do in these cases, and is there any discussion about allowing foot cuffs as a device, an IPC device, to pass this measure?
I'll turn the foot pump part over to Dr. Stimler, but it was originally on the list as far as a recommended therapy, although most people feel that the full IPCs are better than just the foot pumps. And if you have a patient going for bilateral total knee, you can't put the full IPC device on them. When they go for one knee, we put it on the other leg. So if you have an epidural catheter, you also can't use the pharmacologic therapy until the catheter is out, which will be after 24 hours. So I see what the problem is. And under those circumstances, if you're doing bilateral joints, I guess the only option you do have is the foot pumps. But let me turn it over to Dr. Stimler for his opinion.
Right, thanks. Yes, as far as the CMS indicators are concerned for VTE, the use of epidural catheter puts the patient in a special category, which means that they still are required to receive mechanical prophylaxis, at least, that is considered to be adequate by CMS guidelines, and they do not currently consider foot pumps to be adequate mechanical prophylaxis, whereas they are accepting graduated compression stockings and intermittent pneumatic compression devices, but those need to be either calf length or full length on calf and thigh. Venous foot pumps, just as it is to begin with, as Dr. Cohen has pointed out, mechanical prophylaxis is in general considered to be less efficacious than pharmacologic prophylaxis, and venous foot pumps seem to have somewhat less evidence to support them compared with intermittent pneumatic compression for sure, and CMS at this point is not accepting them. So, if there's another mechanical alternative that is conceivable, such as graduated compression stockings or passive compression, that might be the best alternative.
The problem in those patients is you really have that knee immobilized and you really can't put anything over it. So that might have to be an exception in my opinion. But
can low molecular weight heparin be given at, is it, because of the epidural, is it completely contraindicated? Because the manual says patients who receive Naraxyl anesthesia may pass a performance measure if they receive pharmacological prophylaxis. I guess, is the government thinking that that still can be utilized in these cases?
Oh, absolutely. CMS has never said that you cannot use pharmacologic prophylaxis. It's really a clinical decision at that point.
Patient
will not fail if they have an epidural or had a recent epidural and they receive pharmacologic prophylaxis. They don't consider that to be an automatic, algorithmic failure.
So would our only recourse in these particular cases would be to document a contraindication to both the mechanical as well as the pharmacological prophylaxis?
Well, I'd say that if that is the clinical take on the patient, that they're basically both contraindicated, that would be the best approach. And I think we have to kind of go back to the algorithm, look at the abstraction tool, and determine whether that will indeed pass or not. But that, clearly, one of the things that I always say is that you must do what is the best, most clinically appropriate thing for the patient. So, in this special circumstance where perhaps both are contraindicated, you certainly cannot use one or the other if it's merely just to pass a performance measure.
Correct, which is why we're not.
Right, of course, absolutely. And we need to find a way around it if indeed, the circumstance really clinically prohibits the use of both. But, we might, look into this a little bit more and get back to you about it.
If you could, I appreciate it. I guess the problem with the ICD-9 code is that there is no ICD-9 code for a principal procedure for bilateral knee. What they do is they document the single knee and do it twice, which is why it's getting pulled in.
Yes, Elizabeth, you're right on that. I can also follow up with you offline.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
The other alternative you did have is to start warfarin before surgery, so...
Start warfarin before surgery. Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Catherine Riley from Crookdale Hospital.
Hi, this is Lori Baker, Director of Performance Improvement. I have a couple of quick questions for Dr. Simler. First of all, are there any studies since we've been implementing these ACC guidelines that show there's a decrease in the outcome of a DVT-PE occurring once these guidelines have been implemented? Hello?
Yes, actually, I might first bounce the question off of Dr. Cohen to see if he perhaps in his institution had noticed any, whether outcomes had been monitored at all.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the surgical population at all. In the medical population, we don't have enough symptomatic DVTs to say that it was helpful, but there are several papers out there, one from Sam Goldhaber's group up in Boston, that showed that implementing a protocol and reminder process showed that they had better prophylaxis rates and fewer reported DVTs? So the answer, I think, is yes. Now, when you're looking at these, you're talking about symptomatic, which is only going to be about 20%, unless you're routinely screening patients. And most of this ACCP data comes from all studies that had routine screening, either by venography or by ultrasound. And that's including a number of these patients that are going to be asymptomatic that you wouldn't know otherwise. So prophylaxis has definitely been shown to reduce the events. It usually reduces symptomatic events also, but you don't have that many symptomatic patients compared to the numbers that are asymptomatic. So you'd need a very large group to really be able to say in your population that you see a difference.
Well, that sort of would segue into my next question a little bit, because you mentioned that it was based on what was reported DVT. And I am concerned about the new CMS guidelines for the present on admission codes for potentially preventable complications, seeing this is going to be one of our, P4P measures probably in the future. And I know we are in New York State reporting all DVT-PEs that occurred in the hospital or within 30 days of admission. Now, because they were related to a previous discharge. Now, how are the medical records people expected to code to these potentially preventable complications present on admission, say in circumstances when the patient was discharged and readmitted and it was due to the first admission? In that case, they did come in with it. And even for them to identify if it did occur in the hospital or not. There needs to be some guidelines for documentation. It's very difficult for them to be able to find this out, and it's going to be, all related to our quality outcomes. I don't know if there's been any thought into this, how we would, look at this.
As far as the coding goes, what we're doing, or what would be nice if you had the real-time case managers involved, and they would pick it up as it's diagnosed in the hospital, not waiting until it goes to medical records, because I'm sure we're under-reporting a lot of these because we don't find them. And I don't know about the coding, if there's a specific code for in the hospital as opposed to a previous admission and now you have it on admission.
They're the new secondary codes that now are being required for all hospitals by CMS, and were previously in our SPARCS code for present on admission or prior to admission.
I can't address that part of it. I can only address the issues of how to pick them up from a clinical standpoint and report them, but I'll turn it back to somebody else for the coding part of it.
This is Dr. Stimler. I'll make a few comments and then perhaps turn it over to either Karen or Denise. But, I think CMS recognizes the fact that well-performing hospitals, which means hospitals that perhaps superior diagnostic approaches, might paradoxically look worse on an indicator such as this at times, because as Dr. Cohen has pointed out, in a number of points in his presentation, this is like an iceberg. You very often just see the tip of the iceberg, and depending on how far you drill down or pursue clinical suspicion, you may or may not be able to identify DVTs, especially prior to discharge, when you may only have a minority of them in some of the surgical situations. For those hospitals that might be a little bit more aggressive in trying to make the diagnosis, may actually identify more DVTs, probably not PEs, but certainly more DVTs, since the frequency of DVTs is going to be proportionally higher than PEs. But the hospital might actually look worse if one were to simply just look at the incidence rates if they were doing more aggressive sonography or other kinds of diagnostic procedures. For reasons like that, I don't think that anybody is approaching the DVT-PE indicator just on a very simple basis of just plugging it into a pay-for-performance formula and saying, well, if this is higher, then you're doing worse, and if it's lower, you're doing better. I mean, as far as the conversations that I've heard, people have been very concerned that, well-performing hospitals might actually look worse on this. So I don't you know, I actually haven't seen yet any final or even, you know, preliminary specific pay-for-performance formulas coming out from CMS myself that have used this particular indicator, but I anticipate that if they do, it's not going to be a straightforward thing, that it obviously will have to take into consideration these more, you know, clinical issues, because you can't penalize hospitals for doing a better job at diagnosis. Karen or Denise, do you have any other comments?
Denise, do you?
No, not at this time.
Lori, this issue actually just came up last week with another hospital regarding the discharge and readmission time frame being so close and coding. So I have actually forwarded that on to our kiosk for further information and clarification, because we know the present on admission is coming through, I believe, Joint Commission. So I can get back to you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Eve Melcommon from St. Francis Hospital.
Hi, yes, this is Nancy Donnell. I'm one of the clinical specialists at the hospital. And I have two questions related to the intermittent compression. There's been some discussion that the use of other extremities, not just the legs, are beneficial in preventing VTE in using the stockings, the compression stockings. Any comments?
As far as pneumatic compression devices and other things that have been put on people's arms, they say that it does have some effect. It really has not been well studied. In theory, the idea is it's supposed to just improve the circulation, decreasing stasis, but it probably is not as good if it's put on the arm when most of the problems are going to occur in the lower extremities. But there is some support for using them as opposed to using nothing if a patient can't have them on their legs.
And also, when you speak of the spine surgery, are you including spinal orthopedic surgery, not just spinal cord surgery?
Meaning fusions and discectomies and things like that?
Yes.
Yes. Most of those, they're recommending that you actually don't need much unless the patient has other risk factors. And if you do, a lot of times they use it postoperatively, not preoperatively. But you can certainly use the mechanical devices as well if you just wanted to avoid any pharmacologic prophylaxis at the time for a lower risk patient.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kara Levin from St. Peter's Hospital. Ma'am, your line is open. We'll proceed to the next question from Gordon Lunchman from Coney Island.
Yeah, hi, good morning. How you doing? Actually, I have a few comments in relation to some of the other questions that were asked. In terms of overall perspective, I just wanted to give some credit to, I don't know if people are aware, that the Health and Hospital Corporation, all 13 institutions have been involved since 2004 with a major initiative on DVT prophylaxis, and it's being monitored by the task force under the chairmanship of myself and Dr. Fleischman at Queen's Hospital. And we report in excess of 90-95% compliance with some encouraging results. Anyway, I just wanted to, on that perspective, I have a few comments to make, if that's all right with everybody. On the question of cuffs being used in the upper extremity, the data shows it's not just a matter of increase in circulation, but it has been shown that fibrinolytic activity increases with the use of the cuffs, whether it's on the cuff or the foot or the arm. So that's the underlying reason why it should probably be used if the legs are not available. With regard to the question on the initial phone call with surgeons who had a significant bleed post-op, I think we need to make the distinction between a surgical bleed and a bleed caused from anticoagulation. And unfortunately, while I was listening, I was trying to find the actual paper. But the Cleveland Clinic, if you go to their website, they published a very compelling paper in terms of, in the general surgery patient, the use of DVT prophylaxis with low molecular weight heparins and the incidence of bleeding. So if she's looking for some data, I think it would also be helpful there. I have a major concern about the comment on vascular patients, and I would like to raise that question again to the people who make those guidelines. The truth of the matter is a lot of vascular patients are elderly patients with significant comorbidities who are very, very high risk for DVT. And the fact that they're vascular patients and may have anticoagulation during the procedure should, to my mind, not preclude the use of prophylaxis pre and post-op. And I don't know who addresses that in terms of guidelines, but I would say that's a major error to say that those patients don't need prophylaxis. In fact, many times, I'm a vascular surgeon as well, when we do procedures with anticoagulation intra-op, if the patient's high risk for other reasons, or even if we're worried about a graft that may thrombose, we keep patients on anticoagulation post-op as well. So my question is about the setting up of those guidelines. I can't comment on neurosurgical and urological and otherwise, but certainly vascular patients, the risk assessment, as outlined by Dr. Cohen, should be done for that patient, regardless of the fact that he's a vascular patient. And if they need to be on prophylaxis, they need to be on prophylaxis. I want to raise a question again, one more about epidural anesthesia. My understanding was that at the time of placement of the catheter and at the time of removal of the catheter, the guidelines should be followed in terms of either the 12 or 24 hours of stopping the anticoagulation. But that while the catheter is in place, if it's 2 or 3 days, that there was no problem with using anticoagulation. I'd like if Dr. Cohen or Dr. Stimler can clarify on that, please, because that we looked into that with our anesthesia department, and that was my understanding. Sorry for the long-winded questions.
Thanks for the comments. Yeah, you are correct as far as the epidural catheter. An indwelling catheter that's left in for more than a day or at any point, really, you can use pharmacologic prophylaxis with the catheter in place, with the guidelines being you can't remove the catheter until at least anywhere from 8 to 18 hours or so after whatever dose you're using. So you have to plan it appropriately. And a lot of times if the catheter is only going to be in there for 1 day or a day and a half, you really don't have much of a time frame to give more than at most one dose of prophylaxis. So I think that's why it's not done. But if you're planning to leave a catheter in for 2 days or more, then you certainly can give prophylaxis cautiously, pharmacologic prophylaxis cautiously. That's in line with the guidelines. So the specifics were, yes, with respect to inserting a spinal needle or epidural needle or catheter and removal, that's when you needed those time frames. As far as the other thing that you mentioned with vascular surgery, I happened just to look at the recommendations from the ACCP guidelines. They do say that in patients undergoing vascular surgery without additional risk factors, you not routinely use prophylaxis. I personally don't know who's undergoing vascular surgery procedures that doesn't have a risk factor, because they would all, as far as I'm concerned, almost everybody is going to be over the age of 40, and it's a risk factor by itself. So unless we're talking about maybe interventional procedures, which are more like radiology procedures than true vascular surgery, I agree that essentially all vascular surgery patients will be getting prophylaxis, and the vascular surgeons have no problems using anticoagulation.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from, I think we'll find Blonde from Mount Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, I think some of our issues have actually been discussed already, but I just want to point out that we are getting a considerable amount of pushback from some of our orthopedic surgeons, especially as it is in regard to foot pumps. And we are being told that that is the actual standard of care now in orthopedics for hip and knee surgery as opposed to the IPC stockings. And we have also been told that, you know, the major orthopedic institution as well as the orthopedic associations are in support of this. And so this has become an issue, you know, at our organization. And then the other thing, the question had to do with the use of aspirin. And when the recommendation indicates that that you recommend against the sole therapy with aspirin, is that sole pharmacologic therapy with aspirin, or would that include a combination of aspirin and a compression device?
Sole aspirin, and the one time that they have shown aspirin to be of value is actually hip fracture patients, where they added aspirin to whatever regimen patients were using. But in general, I don't think that aspirin should take the place of any of the pharmacologic methods at all. And unless you felt that there was a reason not to use pharmacologic and therefore you were only using mechanical and then you wanted to throw the aspirin in, then I guess it would be okay. No. I would not use aspirin in place of either low-dose unfractionated heparin or low molecular weight heparin. And as far as the foot pumps and the orthopedic societies, although there was one orthopedic physician on the ACCP guideline committee, the orthopedic people in general have always had their own things and not wanted to go along with whatever anybody else said. Not to cast aspersions about the orthopedics, but for years they used aspirin alone in the 1980s before they started using Coumadin. And then they used Coumadin for a long time before they started using low molecular weight heparin. So I don't know if it's just a matter of time until they come around, but yes, they have. So the societies may have their own recommendations that are a little bit different from the ACCP guidelines. But if you look at some of the big joint hospitals, you know, special surgery and joint disease in Manhattan, as opposed to the rest of the places that are doing it, I think they're more standard of care and more state-of-the-art than the rest of the hospitals are. So I would be curious to find out if anybody's online for those hospitals to say what they're using.
We understand that they are using the foot pump.
Are they also using anticoagulants? Because they were.
Oh, yes, they are.
Oh, well, if you want to use a foot pump plus anticoagulant, that's fine. I'm talking about using a foot pump alone instead of using any other therapy.
Oh, no, one of the physicians has a foot pump and aspirin.
Well, that's almost the same as nothing, I think. But that's my opinion.
Okay, we just want to clarify it.
And no extended prophylaxis either?
No.
Okay.
No, he uses aspirin.
I won't say what our people use.
Well, thank you.
This is Denise. We're coming to the end of our scheduled time. So at this time, we're going to take just one more question, and then we just have some more closing remarks before we conclude the call. However, I would invite anyone who had a question and wasn't able to ask it on the call that you can submit it onto the link on Jenny where the conference call materials were posted, and we will do all that we can to get you an answer. I also have my contact information on the second page of the agenda that was included in the material, so I invite you to contact me as well. So I'm going to just take one more question. We'll take one more question, and then we'll just have some closing remarks.
Our final question comes from James and Sarah from Bellevue Hospital. Hi there. Can you hear me?
Barely.
Hello.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I would just like to clarify the question number 6 that you all had reviewed for a patient that's actively bleeding. And what I'm wondering is, does the documentation of active bleeding need to be linked with the documentation of the reason for not ordering the pharmacological VTE prophylaxis?
Yes, it has to be. There has to be a documented risk for the bleeding, for the reason for not ordering the pharmacological, the prophylaxis.
Okay, so even if the patient is actively bleeding, do they have to write bleeding risk, or a patient actively bleeding will not order pharmacological prophylaxis?
Well, I'm sorry, you're asking if they have to write all of that? No, as long as there's documented bleeding risk. Because even in the form that we reviewed earlier, if you just check off active bleeding or if the doctor just writes anywhere in the medical chart that there is this present bleeding risk, then that would suffice.
Okay, so if they document active bleeding, that suffices?
Yes. Am I correct on that, Karen? Just want to verify.
I'd really have to see some of the documentation. I would definitely try to make the link. That's all I can say at this point.
But we could look into that and just clarify that for you later on. Is that okay?
Okay. What should I do? Email you?
Yes, you can email me.
Okay. And your email address is in the packet?
Yeah, it's on the second page of the agenda.
Okay, great. I really appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you.
Good question. Okay, at this time we want to thank everyone for your active participation and for the active discussion and questions and answers. And we'll also again like to thank Dr. Cohn for his presentation and for assisting us with your questions, as well as our own team here at IPRO, Dr. Stimler and Karen O'Leary. Just one announcement I want to make with regards to the SCIP project. For those of you who are not in the SCIP IPG, CMS has designated for this project, which began with the current 8th scope of work, the first quarter 2005 as baseline, and they have designated first quarter 2007 as remeasurement. And those are the two periods that they are going to be comparing to assess the rate of improvement that our hospitals in the IPG have made throughout the course of the project. And the reason I'm mentioning this to everyone is because, as some of you may be aware, during the first quarter 2005 baseline period, CMS did request some medical SCIP charts from hospitals that are not in the IPG for the purpose of comparing their rate of performance with the IPG hospitals. And CMS is now ready to move into the, or they have already removed into the remeasurement phase, and they are going to follow the same protocol where, or process, where they're going to be contacting not only the IPG hospitals, but the non-IPG hospitals as well for some remeasurement charts. So I just want to make everyone aware that you may be receiving these requests. They are going to be in three phases. They sent some requests early last month. They're going to be sending some this month, June 25th, and the next request is going to be July 25th. Now, at this time, we don't have any scheduled time as in regards to which hospitals are going to receive their requests during which phase. But again, we just want to make everyone aware so you get those records in as they are requested to be submitted to the CDAC within 30 days. Of the receipt date. And again, any questions regarding the remeasurement phase that you have for the SCIP project, please feel free to give me a call. And lastly, we want to just remind you to please take a few moments to complete the evaluation form that has been included in the materials, as it does provide us with useful feedback on quality educational activities such as this. So at this time, we'll go ahead and conclude the call. Thank you for joining us again, and have a great day.
Sure. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the conference, and you may now disconnect.